The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thanks for joining me. Tonight, we'll be going to the movies. Well, not exactly, but pretty close. My first guest is Carrie Putnam, the executive director of the Sundance Institute, which, of course, puts on the world-famous Sundance Film Festival. Now, that sounds like a pretty neat job. She describes the importance of the organization this way.
We work in series, we work in theater, we work in documentary, we work in feature film, of course. But supporting artists who tell stories to define their own voices, to not think about telling stories based on what is going to be commercial in the marketplace, what's going to be successful to an audience, but actually what reflects the world we live in.
Yeah.
And to me, a media culture that doesn't have that dimension is a dangerous thing for our democracy.
And then I'll be joined by Joe Daniels, the chief executive officer of the National Medal of Honor Museum. They plan to open the museum on Medal of Honor Day, March 25th of 2023. And where will it be located, you might ask?
Over the last 8 months, we've been looking at places like San Diego and Denver and Dallas and D.C., and we are we're close to making a decision, and it's been really wonderful to see the reception that these cities are giving us.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 23rd. The Philadelphia Orchestra has announced a $50 million gift to its endowment from a donor-advised fund at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, the largest gift in the orchestra's history. For the second consecutive year, charitable giving fell in the first quarter, raising concerns about giving for the rest of the year. The total number of donors in the quarter fell 5.7%, and overall revenue dropped 2.2%. Rotary International has announced grants totaling $100 million in support of global efforts to address the final and most urgent challenges in eradicating polio. Intensifying climate change will increase the future risk of violent armed conflict within countries, according to a study published in the journal Nature. The study estimates climate has influenced between 3 and 20% of armed conflict risk over the last century, and that influence will likely increase dramatically. Researchers found that making one substitution of poultry for beef resulted in an average reduction of dietary greenhouse gases by about half. Child poverty statistics now are as bad as they were in 1990. And finally, Congress has approved legislation that will require most nonprofits to file their tax returns with the IRS in an electronic format that is easily searchable by the public, a move that would give nonprofit officials, regulators, journalists, and scholars a clearer look into a nonprofit's operations. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Carrie Putnam of the Sundance Institute right after this.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful, because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans' families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change when she found Year Up. Like many in her community, she was smart and talented, but didn't have the same opportunities as others. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and experience, entering the healthcare IT field upon graduation. Year Up is a transformative opportunity for motivated young adults and companies looking for talent. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the business of giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
When an event is so iconic, it can overshadow all the other incredible work of the hosting organization. Some might say that is a case with the Sundance Institute, who puts on the world-renowned Sundance Film Festival. But they do so much more than that. And to discover what some of that is, in addition to learning more about the festival itself, I'm delighted to have with us tonight the executive director of the Sundance Institute, Carrie Putnam. Good evening, Carrie, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
Sundance was started by the Sundance kid himself, Robert Redford. What was his founding vision? And share with us some of the history of the festival and of the Institute.
Absolutely. Well, Robert Redford was at the height of his movie stardom in 1980 and, in fact, had just won the Oscar for Best Picture for directing Ordinary People.
Mm-hmm.
And he recognized that there was a time in the entertainment industry and in the movie business where blockbuster culture was rising. Jaws had just happened. Star Wars had just happened. And he, as an artist, had a very personal impulse to try to protect authentic, human, character-driven storytelling and an idea of stories that come from outside the mainstream, come from maybe storytellers who don't typically get chosen by big studios, especially in blockbuster culture. So he brought a few of his friends and a bunch of up-and-coming artists mm-hmm. to the first Sundance Lab in 1981, which was 10 storytellers working on projects that were distinctive, authentic, personal, from really diverse perspectives. And from there, that very personal impulse as an artist to share what he loved and what he cared about, the Institute was born. And that was in 1981. In 1985, the Sundance Film Festival, as we know it today, was born. And that was about taking the work, some of the work that was beginning to be generated out of the Sundance Labs, which are retreat environments that we still have today mm-hmm. for artists now in all sorts of disciplines. Redford was looking for an outlet for those kinds of stories to be shown and created the Independent Film Festival in Park City. And for the first couple of years, it was hard going.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that people knew about or wanted to attend, but suddenly it began to take off. And I think people were craving a different kind of storytelling. People were craving something more immediate, more authentic, more reflective of the world. And the festival was there to meet that need and grew.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it is amazing how the founding vision of an organization, it's really baked into the DNA at the very start, because today, after all this time, it really still is your guiding spirit.
It's absolutely true. And it's one of my favorite things about working at Sundance is how embedded that mission is and mm-hmm. how clear that mission is. And while we think very critically and I think responsively about how to serve that mission in a very different context in time with digital revolutions and a sort of global media culture and many different art forms developing aside from the original independent film,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the grounding of that founding mission and
yeah.
the sort of the clarity of it, and for me, the real urgent need for it that is so compelling. And what's great about working at Sundance is I feel every one of my colleagues and the board, everybody is very connected to that. And so whatever we may do to interpret it, it's understand that it's tethered.
Yeah. And it's so great to hear you say that because, again, I think a lot of people look at the festival as a big marketplace, of which it is, but that is secondary to this vision that Bob Redford came with. So the film festival, when is it held? Where is it held? Park City, you said, that's in
Utah.
Okay. And give us an idea of some of the notable figures who were discovered, if I may say so, at the Sundance Film Festival.
Well, the Sundance, first I'll tell you about when it's held. It's held in January for 10 days in Park City, Utah, and in Salt Lake City, Utah. We actually have two hubs, as well as up at in Provo at the Sundance Resort, which is the property that Robert Redford and his family own where the labs take place. So we have three hubs of the festival. And we have 120,000 unique attendees every year. We have about 200 works of art now in a variety of disciplines, documentary, feature film, new media. And over the years, we've really defined our space in the festival world as discovering and amplifying and providing a launch pad for new voices. Mm-hmm. So this is about what's next. This is about who's going to be influencing our culture, both aesthetically and topically and, sort of in terms of representation in the future. And so starting in the very early years, we had the first film from Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. We had early work from Steven Soderbergh, I think the first film from Steven Soderbergh. We also had a lot of women and a lot of people from different backgrounds in the very early years. We had Alison Anders, who was one of the first women directors at Sundance, and many, many others. But over the years, Kimberly Pierce, who did Boys Don't Cry, and then more recently, Ryan Coogler, Ava DuVernay, Taika Waititi, who directs movies like Thor for Marvel, as well as independent content, and some wonderful documentary filmmakers, Laura Poitras, Roger Ross Williams.
An impressive list.
It's a wonderful list, yes.
You just mentioned that you have 200 projects, but I know that comes from 15,000 submissions. So, Carrie, how in the world do you narrow that down from 15,000 to 200?
Well, I don't do that myself.
You don't look that tired, do you? Yeah, it couldn't be you.
No. So we have a wonderful team of programmers led by Kim Utani, our director of programming, and our festival director, John Cooper. And together, they have a system. We watch the short films account for a large majority of that 15,000. I think the short films are probably about 9,000 of that. And so we have a whole team of short programmers who start in the summer. They each watch about 1,000 films before they're finished. And together, they make their final selections in a panel at the end. And the same thing happens with the features. It's about 4,000, maybe a few more features. And it's just a winnowing process. But every film gets screened beginning to end.
That's very impressive.
And many films get screened multiple times in order to have a really robust conversation. And what I love about their process is in the final, say, they put, the top, say, 300 into a single room and they just duke it out. And really, it's about what they're passionate about, but it's not about any singular point of view. What's really critical, I think, is having a lot of voices of different kinds in that room. And that allows us to have a really cool I think, diverse selection.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere that you would rather have something that people hate than people who feel indifferent about.
Yes.
Just have passion one way or the other,
because
that kind of rises for one reason.
That's
or
right.
Another.
That's right. Well, they I learned shortly after I got there that there is a rating system that the programmers employ, and things get a 1 to a 5. 4 or 5 is great. They always would get a second screening.
Mm-hmm.
But actually often the ones that are reviled are the ones that also get a second look.
That's so
because
interesting.
If a film or any kind of art really evokes a strong point of view, a strong reaction, negative or positive, it's probably got some traction there. There's some spice there. And so that's what we look for.
Yeah, I don't know much about television, but I do know shows, even shows like Seinfeld, had a very, very small audience and probably would have been canceled based on the number of the audience. But the people who did view it felt so crazily passionate about it that passion is actually more important than numbers.
Right, exactly. And sometimes if you're doing something very aesthetically adventurous or something that hasn't been seen before, a reviewer can look at it and be confused or put off. But actually, as it sort of gets out into the world and gets embraced, it can lead us to whole new places.
So what do you believe has been the most significant impact of Sundance on the film industry, on its audiences, on the culture itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think our most significant impact is to, as I said earlier, support artists who tell stories. Mm-hmm. And now we do that in a variety of forms. We work in series, we work in theater, we work in documentary, we work in feature film, of course. But supporting artists who tell stories to define their own voices, to not think about telling stories based on what is going to be commercial in the marketplace, what's going to be successful to an audience, but actually what reflects the world we live in.
Yeah.
And to me, a media culture that doesn't have that dimension is a dangerous thing for our democracy. So I think our biggest impact is bringing voices from the margins into the mainstream, bringing voices of all different kinds to properly hold a mirror up to the society that we're living in ways that people can really engage with, because storytelling is quite accessible. And, you know, so that for me is the main case for what we do, because we believe that those stories have the power not just to, you know, delight or entertain, but also to build connections, empathy, and possibly even social change, depending on where they're heading. So that's our core case statement. Additionally, we, as you mentioned, we have a marketplace. And part of the reason we have a marketplace is because you can tell a story in film, but if you don't end up getting distributed, you know, it's the tree in the forest.
Yeah,
so
right.
So it is important for us to think about not only how do we support these creators in telling the stories they want to tell, but how do we give them a launch pad to be able to get them to the audiences that they want to reach. So as we think about the marketplace at Sundance and the fact that people come in with, you know, having financed their films on their credit cards or however they've done it and end up reaching millions of people, that's a huge impact, I think, to be able to have to be that sort of, as I said, that launch pad. And then third, the question of who's telling stories, I'm sure you're familiar with the woeful lack of representation of most of the population in terms of who's telling stories on mainstream film and television.
Absolutely.
And so we've been very committed for a long time to amplifying all different kinds of voices. And the success rate we've had in getting the artists that have maybe had their start at Sundance moved into careers in film and television outside of the work we support directly has been quite extraordinary as well. So diversifying the mainstream media, creating the independent film sector, and then that launch pad between the two.
Yeah. Let's pick up on that last point. What does it look like right now in terms of the numbers, in terms of women and people of color? As you said, you've been a champion for that across the industry, but also particularly behind the camera. Mm-hmm. I know we have a long way to go, but what kind of progress has been made?
Well, so far we haven't seen a lot of tangible progress in terms of the numbers that are coming out of the research annually in terms of representation of women in color behind the camera. And those numbers are really bad in commercial film and television. Women directors of the top 100 box office are still at about 4.5% of the total. Women of color barely even register on the percentage, and men of color not much better. So I think the progress as measured by the data has not yet hit. But what I'm seeing is the pipeline of talent is really exciting. And people in decision-making roles who are financing content are recognizing that there's a vast untapped marketplace for stories about people who are not straight white men. And so I think the combination of the talent ready for opportunity and a recognition that there's a market out there is going to lead to the change we want to see. But we also have to recognize that there's a lot of entrenched culture around how decisions are made, what's deemed commercial, who's deemed ready for leadership behind the camera. Mm-hmm. These are things we have to work on through culture shift, leadership shift, awareness change. And, you know, we try to do a bit of all of that through our advocacy efforts.
Because it really all gets down to the money. Because I think if you take a look at your labs, it's 50-50 more or less. Yeah. But when you look at this 4%, it has to do who is receiving the financing. We had a Gene Case of the Case Foundation on the show recently. We were talking about venture capital. only 3% of all the money goes to women. Now, more projects, I think it's 10% of women, but of the actual dollars, only 3%. And you somewhat have a parallel here in the industry where they just can't get the financing to get their great ideas out on the big screen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Stacey Smith at USC Annenberg calls it the fiscal cliff for
like
women
that.
And creators of color.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we find, Sundance is a great data set for that. And when we opened up our data for over 13 years of submissions to our labs, our festival acceptances, and then looking at how people built careers, we found a significant gap between women and other underrepresented voices and their male counterparts in terms of advancing their careers,
mm-hmm.
seeking, getting financing from labs to festival, and then, you know, going on to the next steps, making second films.
Carrie, if there had been a blind spot around diversity and inclusion, it might have been the critics who were invited to come and review the films at the Sundance Film Festival, but you have really addressed that issue in a big way. Tell us what you've done.
Yeah. Well, I think we had a blind spot, if I'm honest. We in our organization spend so much time thinking about how we curate, how we select the projects that we support both in our labs and in the festival. And we think a lot about the table setting for launching them into the world in terms of the industry we invite, the ways we promote the work. But the missing piece was the press.
Mm-hmm.
And what we failed to recognize is bringing a wide array of stories, both domestic and international, from many different kinds of storytellers and having them all mediated by a press that looks very homogenous. Most of the critics in this country are, again, straight white men.
Yeah.
And the cultural mediation that happens in the way a critic receives a new piece of work can be make or break for that work going on to get a deal or going on to meet the audiences, which, of course, is the goal. So a year ago, I was having a conversation with some of the filmmakers at the festival who were experiencing this problem, who said, we knew that they had a wonderful film, but somehow the reviewers weren't getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And remember one conversation in particular with Boots Riley, who made a film called Sorry to Bother You, who felt that the critics at the festival were sort of missing the point that he knew his audiences would get. And, of course, he did get a terrific deal and his movie came out and did beautifully in the market, not just for the audience that he imagined, but for many audiences.
Yeah.
But it was a moment where he was at risk of being misinterpreted.
Could have been a missed shot.
So we decided to try to do something about it. And with the support of an incredible consortium of funders that we assembled pretty quickly, because it was something that we had to create an intervention on quickly, including the Ford Foundation and Nathan Cummings, that have been real leaders in this area,
mm-hmm.
in particular, as well as OSF and MacArthur and Emerson Collective, and some corporations too, Netflix, Rotten Tomatoes. We decided to invite a vastly different group of press to join the traditional press corps that comes to Sundance, and we provided stipends to enable them to come, because it's quite expensive.
That's great.
And then mentorship and orientation, and helped them interpret the festival however they chose to interpret it, but recognizing that having different sort of voices in the room would make a difference in terms of how the work was received. And together, those critics that we brought in, which ended up being 63% of our press corps from traditionally underrepresented groups, including women, I think they got 123 million impressions on their stories. So
mm-hmm.
it was pretty great.
Yeah, pretty great. Did you see a difference in terms of the way these films were reviewed and how they are now faring from this past festival?
It's too early to say that.
Yeah.
I think what we felt is a difference in the public square at the festival, which
yeah.
is how I like to think about the festival.
That's a nice
is
way
this
to put it.
is this communal space where we share art and ideas, and I think it's always richer for having more voices in it.
You know, what caught my attention before is when you said that Sundance Labs actually preceded the Sundance Film Festival. And I guess that underscores the importance that Robert Redford had put on trying to help filmmakers in a whole variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that, what you do for these mm-hmm. filmmakers, and about some of your labs.
Absolutely. Well, as I mentioned, the very first lab was for writer-directors
yep.
in independent film. And the model that was set there has been adapted over the years, but really worked, and
mm-hmm.
we've largely kept, which is selecting artists based on their project, bringing them to a retreat environment, which we believe that connection between creativity and nature in a retreat is really special for what can happen creatively, and then surrounding them with mentors, peers, with more experience, but peers in their fields to develop the language of their particular piece of work. This is not about general education. This is not it's not like film school where you're learning how to write a scene or how to shoot a scene. You're really trying to figure out what your voice is as an artist, what your project is. It's extremely customized. And so our director's lab continues today. It's a 3.5-week residency mm-hmm. in the mountains of Utah. Okay. But in addition, we've moved into other forms, as I mentioned before. So we have documentary edit labs. We have two theater maker labs. We have film music. We have New Frontier, which is stories that live on the intersection of art and technology. Sort of pushing new media forward, which is pretty amazing. We have producers' labs and a wide array of episodic storytelling, series storytelling, wide array of disciplines. We also have recognized more recently, I think, that supporting artist projects in the form of labs is terrific and unique for us as a model that we build. But it's also important to think about the life of the artist, the whole artist. And so we've launched several fellowships to separate from supporting a project to really support an artist either in an emerging career, moving towards making, you know, their first big work, or sustaining careers, thinking about how you get to your second film. We have a fellowship called Film 2 specifically for addressing that problem we were talking about earlier about the lag time that a lot of creators have between getting their first project and their second one, particularly if they're women or other underrepresented storytellers. So fellowships are now a big part of what we do.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because I don't think enough people think about the livelihoods of these artists. We were thinking about them getting funding for their project. But in the meantime, they have to live someplace and they have to eat. And I know you and I were talking before we got on the air about how venture philanthropy and venture capital never thinks of the artistic community mm-hmm. when they're thinking about trying to create some social impact. Mm-hmm. We think about the on-the-ground social entrepreneur, mm-hmm. but profound change comes from the arts. It hits a different part of the people's brain, and they look and think about an issue completely differently. So I'm so glad to see that you're doing something in that arena.
Yeah, and there's a lot of science behind that too in mm-hmm. terms of what narratives penetrate our fixed ways of thinking, and it is stories. And I think we've been extraordinarily lucky to have a lot of foundations who do work. I mean, one great example, the Skoll Foundation, who works with social entrepreneurs all over the world, does recognize the power of storytelling in the work of their entrepreneurs. And we've had a 10-year partnership with them called Stories of Change that puts storytellers and artists and social entrepreneurs together to try to create awareness and engagement with some of these, you know, important issues around the world that people have trouble really relating to without a piece of media or a piece of art to help them get to.
Yeah.
And there's many other partners like that we have. I think what we find in particular is that in documentary, people are recognizing that nonfiction storytelling can move forward really important issues. Another great example for us is we had a film called The Invisible War, which is about rape in the military. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that film, Kirby Dick, Amy Ziering, that film was made independently, you know, deep investigation. But in the end, it got to the top of the chain in the military and really made changes in the way procedures happened yeah. and
these
awareness around these
you.
Issues.
Really
so
do.
Media does work.
Carrie, Sundance has an extensive network of partners and affiliates and contributors and supporters. What is the business model of the Institute, and how do you get all this work done?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think there's a perception, because the festival is so well-known and because the festival has a marketplace attached to it, that somehow the festival and the ticket sales and the buzz around that drive what we do.
All you need.
and in fact, the model for our organization is 67% of our revenue is contributed. The rest is earned revenue from ticket sales and merchandise and other stuff associated with the festival. And out of that 67%, it's about a third, a third, and a third corporations, foundations, and individuals. And we really rely on a wide range of stakeholders to help make this storytelling world come to life. I really love to share with people that there are so many ways to engage with Sundance as a believer in art and sort of aesthetics and creativity, but also thinking about art as a tool for social change, thinking about representation as a way to make a fairer world in terms of the stories that we see that help us tell us what we value. So that's the kind of people that come to us.
You know, another thing that's been a big challenge is trying to even the playing field some where the power of data can get into the hands of the independent creator. Because at the end of the day, it's a competitive marketplace. Who is the audience? How do you market it? How do you do comps when you want to try to get financing for it? And here you're going against the studios. You're going against the platform. So it's a considerable disadvantage for the independent. I know you have tried to get your arms around that a little bit. Tell us about how that's been going.
I think access to data today is power. And I
no
think
matter
the
what
power,
the industry, you're absolutely right.
The power is being aggregated in the hands of very few. As we see the consolidation that's happening in the media business overall, you've heard about all these mergers and all the changes that have happened. And of course, with the rise of the technology-based streamers that, you know, Netflix and Amazon and others that have harnessed the power of data to market in really targeted ways, it's been both a great opportunity for a lot of storytellers to be able to be on those platforms and have access to the data that they have. But that data is held very tightly by all of those companies. Mm-hmm. And it is a small minority of great independent artists who actually get the chance to be on those platforms. Mm-hmm. So for the rest of them, it's sort of feast or famine, because if you don't have access to data and you don't have the ability to leverage technologies that exist to help you find the audience that might want to see your work through data, through recognizing patterns in terms of viewership, it becomes much more difficult. So we did try to launch a project to address this and thought about trying to create a commune of data sharing among independent artists and it ended up being really difficult even to get the independent artist who sold the rights to be able to report on their own data that was owned by a company. So it was really hard to do.
Yeah. You have said that when you lead an organization, you find yourself thinking a lot about the corporate culture. How do you think about workplace culture, Carrie, and what are some of the specific things that you've done to make the Sundance Institute a really special place to work?
Well, yes, I do. I think it's hugely important, and I love my colleagues at Sundance. I think I talked about it a little bit at the beginning. I think alignment around purpose and really, really believing that being animated by a mission or a purpose is something that connects us and is why we come to work every day, and bringing that into the work as much as we can. So connecting everybody who works in the organization, whether they're in finance or human resources or on the front lines with the artists, with the idea of why we do what we do. That's a really important first thing. The other things are good ideas come from anywhere. So finding formats and finding context where we can share ideas across disciplines, across programs, break down the walls that exist between traditional functions. We've spent a lot of time on trying to find new ways of working that are more team-oriented. And it can be a really big culture shift to do that. But I think the benefits in terms of the imagination and the efficiency that comes out of that sort of work is terrific.
And everybody feels a real part of the organization, as opposed into their little cubbyhole doing their things. They feel that they can have voice across the organization. And it also helps provide clarity for their own job, knowing how it leads to the mission. They know exactly what they do that ultimately gets us to the ultimate objective.
Yeah, that's the goal. And you know, nothing's perfect. I think like many organizations that have grown, we've grown pretty significantly over the past several years as we've expanded into more disciplines and expanded that artist-centered practice that I mentioned. And, you know, growth can be challenging on a culture, so figuring out how to marry the sort of agility and forward-looking qualities that we're seeking in the work we want to do going forward with that firm grounding in the mission and the history and the legacy of the organization.
Yeah.
That's an exciting aspect of creating culture because that becomes the vital mix you're looking
for.
Yeah.
And it all gets down to communication as well, because every time you grow, the old way of communicating is no longer effective for this larger cohort in which you have.
Right.
So you have to think about how to get that message across. Tell us a little bit about your personal journey. Now, I know that it started with books and stories.
Yes.
And then thanks to your parents in New Jersey, it reached out to theater.
Yes.
But tell us a little bit about that background and some of the milestones in your career.
Absolutely. Well, I've always loved stories. I was an avid geek, I guess, as a kid, just reading books mostly and immersing myself in other worlds. And I just loved that. And theater was the first accessible art form, living, as you said, in New Jersey, that I could get to frequently. And I saw some terrific theater that really opened my mind in my high school years, and ended up studying theater, working in the nonprofit theater during college and a little bit after. But found my way through my love of writers and by complete happenstance to HBO, where I was hired by a guy who was trying to bring theater to television.
Mm-hmm.
So I was lucky to be his – I was hired as an assistant at the very bottom. I didn't know anything. I got my foot in the door.
Yeah.
I was a very bad assistant, but I had a really great set of mentors at that company, and I was lucky to be – in HBO at a time where it was just really getting off the ground in terms of original programming. And so learning how to develop stories, work with writers, and then ultimately do productions, my rate of learning was growing at about the same rate as the company. So I was able to stay there a long time and grow and learn and watch HBO become a powerhouse through the power of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I also learned at HBO the power of a shared, clear mission. Because we had it. We understood that the kinds of stories we were going to support were going to break new ground in different ways than what network television was doing at
Those
that time.
Those were heady days. You were changing the world.
It felt great to be part of it, and I was relatively small part of it until, you know, years later. But so I spent a good part of my career at HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was offered the chance to run production at the Disney-run Miramax,
mm-hmm.
which was after Harvey Weinstein
right,
left the
right.
company.
Yeah.
And I loved that opportunity, too, because got to work with sorts of filmmakers like Stephen Frears on The Queen or the Coen brothers on No Country for Old Men or Paul Thomas Anderson on There Will Be Blood, many others.
Yeah, good stuff.
Just the films were wonderful. The colleagues were great. Unfortunately, you know, Disney was going a different direction in terms of where Bob Iger wanted to take the company, and Miramax wasn't in his plans, so it got shut down. And that for me was the real watershed moment,
mm-hmm.
because I looked around in my own way and said, I've loved working with storytellers that have very distinctive voices and are doing something a bit more personal. And I see where the studios are going. I see where my next job will be if I end up in the sort of conventional studio world. And then I heard about the Sundance job. I didn't even know this job existed, and was lucky enough to get a chance to try it. And I haven't looked back. It's been fantastic.
Well, it sounds that way. Let me close with this, Carrie. You know, one of the fabulous things about working at Sundance is that you get to see exactly what's going on in the culture and perhaps can spot some trends before the rest of us can. So with that being said, do you sense or see anything now that people like me will be hearing about for the first time in about 3 years?
That's a great question. On the documentary side right now, we're seeing a ton of interesting stories about AI and about data ethics and about what's privacy and where what we've given up in a sort of a dystopian way in terms of the conveniences that we have. And I think as these stories come, we'll then see some narrative stories that go into that territory. And I think there's a whole new future of dystopian nonfiction and fiction that we might see around that. Additionally, I think there's been you know, I look at something like The Farewell, which is a movie by Lulu Wang that was at our festival this year. It's a family drama about Asian American characters. It's a kind of a story that everybody can relate to, but has a different set of people than you typically see in films. And I think more and more we're seeing stories that represent a fuller spectrum of people going into genres and places and forms that we might typically have not seen inhabited by a wide range of people. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of those coming in the future.
It's fresh stuff.
Exactly.
You know, some of the other stuff has gotten a little tired and a little worn. These are completely new stories.
Exactly.
You know, as far as the AI is concerned, it's interesting how these documentaries were just science fiction movies a while ago, and now they're actually – but they're not that much different.
Absolutely.
Well, Carrie Putnam, the executive director of the Sundance Institute, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what people will find there, and what people can do if they would like to support this work.
Absolutely. Well, it's www.sundance.org, and you can find plenty of ways to engage with our work there. You can become a member, which we have members all over the world, support storytelling in that way. You can be a partner. You can, you know, be a major donor. There's plenty of ways to engage. But also take a look at something new we launched on our website. It's called Sundance Collab, and it's a platform that we just in beta now. We launched to empower independent storytellers all over the world. We started it about 6 months ago, and I think we already have more than 12,000 storytellers
Impressive.
In nearly 200 countries sharing their work, sharing ideas, amplifying new voices. So you can look at that too.
Well, thanks, Carrie. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Sport is the common denominator in the world. And if there's any place where there's equality, it's really in sports.
RISE stands for the Ross Initiative in Sports for Equality. We're dedicated to promoting understanding, respect, and equality in sports and beyond.
We want people to speak up, take the pledge, and rise up against racism.
And we'll rise up.
I pledge to treat everyone
with respect,
and dignity.
I will not tolerate discrimination
or harassment
of any kind.
I will speak up.
Speak up.
Whenever I know discrimination is happening, and I will stand up.
Get up.
Rise up for victims.
Take the pledge at risetowin.org.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
At a time when we agree on so little, it's good to have an initiative that everyone can subscribe to and rally around. And that would be saluting those who have been awarded the National Medal of Honor. And now there's a museum in the works to tell the stories of these service members who received our nation's highest honor. And here to discuss that with us is Joe Daniels, the former CEO of the National 9/11 Memorial Museum and currently the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum Foundation. Good evening, Joe, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thanks for having me, Denver.
What is the history of the Medal of Honor, sometimes referred to as a Congressional Medal of Honor, and how is it conferred?
You know, the Medal of Honor was started back in the Civil War, and it was created by President Lincoln to honor those that, you know, went above and beyond the call of duty. And it's interesting, although there's been about 3,500 medals awarded in our nation's history since then, It wasn't until World War One, really, that there all of the other medals that were, or many of the other medals that we're familiar with today, be it the Silver Star, mm-hmm. the Bronze Star, Distinguished Service Crosses, came onto the scene. So as far as the sort of elite nature as now the nation's highest award for valor in combat, even the 3500 doesn't fully capture how sort of elite this medal is and the sort of heroism that the medal represents. It's an incredible, the guys that have earned it, when you read their stories, they're always almost by definition just incredibly daunting circumstances for which in a moment or in a short time period, they've just done incredibly selfless and courageous acts many times to save their fellow soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And I think Teddy Roosevelt is the only president to have received one.
Yes, he was. And he was also, I just learned this yesterday or a couple of days ago, Teddy Roosevelt is the only president that earned the medal, and he's also the only one to earn a medal and also the Nobel Peace Prize, which someone at the Soldiers and Sailors Monument up on 89th and Riverside, when I was speaking at a Memorial Day ceremony a few days ago, pointed out to me. So, pretty special guy.
Yeah, that's quite the combo. The idea of this museum has been kicking around for a long time. What was a catalyst to do it now, and where is this museum going to be built?
Yeah, the idea has been kicking around. I mean, there's so many different ways to look at why we should have a Medal of Honor museum. I think that, you know, just at one level, as an example, we have Hall of Fames for all of our sports leagues. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally what those places are doing is saying, you know, we have this lots of folks in society participate in an activity, and we want to step back and look at those that really define the best of the best in that activity. And the reality is that our military, you know, there's been over 40 million Americans that have served in the military, and 1/100th of those, even less than that, have earned the highest award for valor. And so the idea is that the values that underlie the Medal of Honor, which is, you know, integrity, courage, compassion, and putting others above self, we have a real opportunity to share those stories with future generations to remind people that this 243-plus year experiment as a nation is just that. It's an experiment, mm-hmm. and there is simply no guarantee that we just continue. And so reinforcing the sense to all Americans, to all generations, particularly the younger generations, that there is a responsibility to contribute to this experiment is really, really important. And I think doing that through the lens of these recipients, of these, oftentimes the medal is awarded to those who are in frontline combat, so they often tend to be the more junior individuals who are participating, and they're, you know, they come from small towns, big cities all over the nation, and in moments where they had to make really, really impossible decisions, have stepped up to do so. And we think that those stories can inspire people in their civilian lives to be the best of who they can be.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, because these Medal of Honor awardees are a humble group and don't particularly go out of their way to tell their story. But knowing the inspiration they can provide to the next generation is probably one of the reasons they've embraced it.
I think that's exactly right, Denver. I mean, and honestly, one of the reasons that I, you know, after spending 12 years as the CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, in deciding what I wanted to do as my next undertaking, mm-hmm. it really was that aspect that you just mentioned. And I remember way back in 2005, we were always going to build a memorial as a nation to those 2,983 individuals that were killed, but that was the right thing to do to honor those. And there was tons of controversy about what the memorial would be, but it was clear that we should honor those that were lost. But the question of a 9/11 museum was pretty hotly debated, and I remember some very specific conversations with individuals in the FDNY and the NYPD that essentially said, look, we were just doing our jobs that day. So many of our fellow firemen or cops, they never made it out. And all we were doing is what we were supposed to do. And we don't need a big museum to us. And the conversation that we had with them was essentially comes down to, this is a museum, or that was a museum, that although it was about them, it wasn't necessarily for them. And it was this idea that they can make a even further contribution to the city they love, to the country they love, by allowing us to use their stories to inspire the millions of people that have visited that museum. And I know for a fact that there have been millions of kids that have gone through the 9/11 museum, gone back to their towns across the country, and the first time that they see a firefighter or a cop, they look at them with just this additional and enhanced level of respect. And similar in this case, it's the same thing with the recipients. At the first discussions, and as you said, this idea has been batted around forever, but I think that what we've been able to do in the last year is sort of change the valence of the discussion in talking to the recipients and really reinforce that, yes, this is a museum about you, but it's not a museum for you. Mm-hmm. And they have really sort of latched on to that, because they are a very humble bunch. And to a man, and there's only, unfortunately, 70 living recipients, which is another sort of driver of why we need to get this project done. But the they always talk about, they don't wear the medal for themselves. They wear it for those that never came home. They are part of a continuum of service in this country. And so the idea is that some kid is going to go through the future Medal of Honor Museum, be inspired by these stories. And when they find themselves, as an example, in a place that we've all been in, which is to be a silent witness watching some poor kid get bullied, in that moment, because of that inspiration, they're going to step forward and say, hey, leave that kid alone. And it's that idea of inspiring civilians to be their best that is really the impetus behind the National Medal of Honor Museum.
Oh, that's a great impetus. Well, speaking about the museum, I know it's still in the early innings. Have you found a home for it yet? I know you've been looking. And do you have a target date when you would like to see this opened?
Yeah, so originally it was slated to be built in a town in South Carolina called Mount Pleasant. And you know, the reason it was there is sort of this it's sort of an interesting meta look at how projects get sited and located. The Medal of Honor Society, which is the group that all living recipients are a part of, happens to have their headquarters on the USS Yorktown. Mm-hmm. It used to be on the Intrepid up here in New York. And then in the 90s, they decided to move it to another aircraft carrier, which they did, which happened to be the Yorktown. And then this idea started to get kicked around that we should build a land-based National Medal of Honor Museum. And basically, when I got down there and I brought some folks from my 9/11 team, we really understood pretty quickly that if we want to build a museum that has as our mission the highest impact on the country, then one of the first principal questions is, what location gives us the best chance to do that? And as great as that area is, and I've had just nothing but good things to say about Mount Pleasant and Charleston, it's a relatively small market.
Yep.
It's a lot of places people want to go to, but we are looking at measuring our visitation in millions and not thousands. And so we have been undergoing what we're calling a targeted national search. Over the last 8 months, we've been looking at places like San Diego and Denver and Dallas and D.C., and we're close to making a decision. And it's been really wonderful to see the reception that these cities are giving us. I mean, fundamentally, they understand, particularly with the team that was able to build the 9/11 Museum and Memorial, that this is going to be something that is nationally visible. This is going to be America's next national treasure, and it's a huge sort of patriotic entity that will be in their city. And ideally, and we're working hard towards it, and I expect we'll be able to meet it, but that we're looking to announce our new home by the end of September of this year. And then we're looking at about 4 years to build, 3.5 to 4 years. And our ideal target date is Medal of Honor Day, which very few people know is a day. It's March 25th,
right.
And that would be 2023. And one of the things that I've talked to my team about is it'll be an interesting metric over time, is that as we undertake this process of reaching out to America to raise the money that we need to collect the stories that we need, we want to also bring, of course, tremendous visibility to the Medal of Honor, to Medal of Honor Day, so that hopefully at some point, if we do our jobs right, March 25th will be a very significant day in America every year.
Yeah, great to give greater focus to that day. Finally, Joe, you recently announced the formation of Links in the Chain. This is a brand new partnership. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Links in the Chain is just a wonderful partnership that we've started. We sort of decided at the beginning, you know, there are so many incredible service organizations and military and vet-focused organizations in this country, and how wonderful would it be, sort of as a stamp of credibility for us as an entity, to partner with these guys to get their support and to have a relationship with their members. I think that, you know, the hardest part of building a museum, and this was certainly our case back in 2005, is before, when you're just plans on paper, there's always people, it's very easy, and I think, you know, from your listeners' perspective and so many of the folks that you've interviewed with, you know, doing big things is really hard, and a lot of, unfortunately, there's a tendency to just feel a bit like this is never going to happen. And that is always the case until it actually does happen. And of course, the first markers of success are often the bricks and mortar of putting the, you know, piling and supports and building the structure. But until you get that point, it's really important to show the donor community and those that want to, you know, send in the $5 or write the big checks that this is going to happen. Part of that is the experience we're able to show.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part, the Links in the Chain part, is to say that, you know, places like the Navy SEAL Foundation or the VFW or Semper Fi, these major organizations that reach millions of people, believe in this project, want this project to happen. So that's what this is all about at this stage. It's raising awareness. They've committed to helping us connect with their members. One of the things that's really important to us is that, you know, there's a lot of oral histories that have already been done about from the recipients.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that we want to focus on is what is the legacy of those recipients. So even meeting family members who had a grandfather that was a World War I Medal of Honor recipient and learning how that impacted their family across the generations. There's a lot of people that know recipients or have heard stories. So we really want to make this a national project, and having these tremendous partners as a part of it is just, it's a huge boost for us.
It's a big help. One corollary to that, if I can add, Joe, is that after it has been built, people will look at it and say, oh, that was easy. That was a natural. And you're like, oh, no, it wasn't. Well, Joe Daniels.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, especially with I remember specifically way back in the day when I became president of the Memorial and Museum, after Mayor Mike gave me the job.
Yeah.
I would come home and my wife would ask me, you know, how was your day, basically? And I'd say, I love this. I love what I'm doing, but I don't know if we're going to be around in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, there was so much, you know, and that's a whole other case study in the sense that the emotional politics were so tremendous. And still to this day, you know, the fact that 40% of all of the 9/11 family members, they never got any human remains back to lay their loved ones to rest.
Mm-hmm.
And we're building on the very last site that their loved ones were ever seen, you know, added an emotional component to it. This is different in the sense that, you know, that urgency, very few people, put it this way, wake up in this country and say, where the hell is that National Medal of Honor Museum? Obviously, my board, the staff is doing that. And what that says, though, is that we really need to, as a part of our project, which is why we're doing Links in the Chain, is to raise awareness that, as you pointed out to start the show, you know, there are so few things that the left and the right can agree on. And this, the values that underlie the medal, is one of those things. And I really believe that we have this obligation that to build this national treasure, to build the National Medal of Honor Museum, something that can unite all of us. And whether it's the, you know, the recent and terrible school shootings out in Denver or what happened at UNC Charlotte, you see individuals that are civilians. And again, the parallel to 9/11 is really tight. I mean, as much as we appropriately praise those first responders, there's hundreds and hundreds of stories of civilians in those buildings that day who did incredible things for those that they were there with. And it's the same thing here. And it's the DNA of the medal about putting others above self that we really want to highlight. And we're going to do that through some of the most powerful emotional narratives that exist in American history.
Well, Joe Daniels, President and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum Foundation, thanks so much for being here this evening. For people to learn more or become involved or help support this work, tell us about your website.
Yes, I very much appreciate that. People can go to mohmuseum.org and follow our progress and donate. And frankly, what I can say is, you know, whether you can give a dollar or $10 or more than that, there is something very special that this is. We are talking about at the ground floor. We are right there, but we are going to make this happen. And the pride that a family can feel in donating now and about 4 years from now, when the eyes of the country, every living president, every living Medal of Honor recipient, thousands of veterans and members of the public are there to open that museum. The idea that someone stepped forward at this time to donate is really important. So if people go to mohmuseum.org, they'll have a chance to get involved.
Thanks, Joe. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
You bet. Thanks, Denver, so much.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Sion Bylock, the president of Barnard College. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do come back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.